We have with us live in the studios once again, Maria Tomchik, formerly with Eat the Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
All right. No job this morning. He's
still a little under the weather.
Under the weather. Perhaps next week we shall see. But nonetheless, we are charging forward with our traditional end of the year wrap up that you previously have done.
Yes, and this week I'm going to cover the local stories that were the most underreported this year. I've got about 10 of them here in no particular order. So let's get started on that.
All right.
This year, a lot of money was spent on transportation projects, mostly construction projects. And when you look at those, you think, wow, you know, all of that money being poured into building, you know, new capacity for cars or at least trying to make things a little bit more efficient in our transportation system around the Puget Sound region. And no, in fact, that was not the main goal of all of that money being poured into transportation this year. It was for real estate development and for mostly tourist projects. If you look at the projects I'm talking about, like the Mercer Corridor Beautification Project that opened and for traffic this year, two-way traffic on Mercer Street. And a lot of people that I talk to who use the Mercer Corridor frequently, daily or more frequently, were just completely puzzled because now their trip is a lot longer than it used to be. And I find myself having to remind them that yes, when the city council voted on funds for the Mercer Corridor Beautification Project, that they knew from the city Department of Transportation studies that the Mercer Corridor was not going to become a more efficient arterial because of the changes. It was actually going to increase travel times on Mercer to make it a two-way street, and that the real goal of making those changes on Mercer was to boost the property values in South Lake Union, particularly for properties owned by Paul Allen and other big developers. So that's just one example. We saw Bertha come to a screeching halt late the year before in 2012, and it's been sitting idle for the entire year, buried deep beneath Pioneer Square. Now we're starting to see buildings sinking and cracks in the street above it. And in the meantime, the Department of Transportation has been moving full steam ahead on the other improvements for the tunnel on both ends of the tunnel project, and they've been getting ready to take down the viaduct. But it seems quite clear that Bertha is going nowhere. We got the news just this week that the tunnel boring project is going to be at least 2 years behind schedule at this point. That's if they can get Bertha out of the ground and get it fixed, which is nobody's quite sure that that's actually going to happen. So, you know, you look at that and you go, really, is this for transportation, given that they're going to have to take the viaduct down fairly soon? And when they do that, the current plan now, they've shifted their planning to divert traffic now onto city streets, which was one of the options in replacing the viaduct in the first place, was to expand a roadway along the waterfront and then just divert a lot of the traffic from the viaduct onto city streets and other arterials. And that's, it turns out, is what we're going to get while Bertha sits idle in the ground. So you look at that and you go, okay, really, the whole tunnel project was an excuse to redevelop the waterfront, and that's absolutely true. And then the other huge project that is getting a lot of city transportation dollars is the expansion of the trolley system. The downtown connector, which was supposed to connect the First Hill trolley to the South Lake Union trolley, might have actually been a somewhat viable transit project if it went up Fifth Avenue, or if it went up Third Avenue. But no, they decided the city council decided the most optimal alignment was First Avenue, which really turns it into a toy train for tourists to take them up along the waterfront, essentially. So, you know, you look at these projects and all the money that is going into them and what is going to be their net impact in terms of making transportation more efficient. It's going to be very, very small, if not a negative one.
All right, moving on. Rent increases.
Oh, yeah. Seattle had the biggest rent increases rent increase in the nation's 50 biggest cities. Seattle's rent increase was 11% from 2010 to 2013, according to the Census Bureau. And meanwhile, and that is literally the biggest rental increase over that time period of any of the largest cities in the United States. Meanwhile, we had a 14% increase in homelessness in 2014, just this year. If you look at the city budget, homelessness got quite a bit of funding, which is good. But when it came time to fund affordable housing projects, the city said, well, you know, let's give a little money to a two-year study to try to figure out what we might be able to do for affordable housing. So again, the main cause of one of the city's biggest and most visible problems, the fact that we have an ever-increasing homeless population, that the Downtown Business Association perceives an increase in crime in downtown, I think mostly because they're seeing a lot more homeless people and a lot of litter, which comes when people are living on the street. You know, and there is, you know, a lot of petty crime when you have a lot of people living on the street. There's a lot of criminals who will prey on homeless people. That is very visible now, particularly since former Mayor Nichols instituted a policy of sweeping the homeless out of their homeless encampments. And when there's no place for homeless people to go to camp out, they tend to hang out on the city streets. And a lot of them have been hanging out downtown, and that creates the perception of more crime. They look at, oh, what should we be doing to deal with the homeless without asking what is the cause of homelessness? And in this case, a major cause of homelessness is the rapidly increasing rents. Now, we saw this year a lot of news articles, particularly in the Seattle Times, about how, oh, Seattle's rents are not higher than other major cities. You know, comparatively, they're not higher than San Francisco. They're not higher than New York, et cetera. But it's not the actual amount that people are paying for rent, it's the rate at which it increases that is very important, because people's incomes don't keep pace. And when people's incomes don't keep pace with that huge double-digit increase, then you're going to see a lot of people who can't afford rent being pushed out onto the street. And that's the real issue here that didn't get coverage.
All right. Moving on. Permits coming out of the State Liquor Control Board.
Yeah, the State Liquor Control Board this year took its time, really took its own sweet time, issuing licenses for recreational marijuana. That was licenses for producers, for folks who were going to grow it, issuing licenses for people who were going to process and retail it, too. And so what happened in July, when marijuana became legal, is we had only one outlet in the city of Seattle that opened for business, and that is frankly ridiculous. Also, they issued permits that were so late in the growing season that there was an obviously going to be a shortage of supply, and that drove the price up. And when that happens, what you get is a lot of people turning to street dealers to buy their drugs, and it really boosts the black market and the illegal trade in marijuana. So, you know, you look at that and you go, really, this looks to me like the state is dragging its feet and really is trying to do its best to sabotage the legal market for marijuana in the state of Washington. Because at this point, as far as I'm aware, you've only got a couple of outlets still open in the city of Seattle to cover the entire population of the largest metropolitan area in the state. And that's just not going to be sufficient for the demand. And so what you're getting, of course, is not just homelessness in downtown Seattle. You're getting a lot of people going downtown to buy their legal marijuana from dealers who are not legally licensed.
And where the state isn't getting any tax.
Where the state is not collecting the tax, which was one of the big points of legalizing marijuana in the first place.
All right. Primera Blue Cross.
Yeah, Primera Blue Cross killed the all-payer claims database. Now, the all-payer claims database was something that the state could set up under the Affordable Care Act to allow the public to see how much various doctors and hospitals charge for various medical procedures, to be able to price shop and compare, and to also see the effectiveness rating of different doctors in different hospitals to find out, okay, am I paying a lot of money to a doctor who's not very good, or is there a doctor who charges a little less but has a higher effectiveness rating? It really was one of the main tools that people should have been able to use under the Affordable Care Act to bring down the cost of health care. And doctors said that they were on board with it. They liked it. Hospitals liked it. Also, other insurance companies lined up and said, oh, yeah, we think this is a really good idea because it will lower our costs. And even businesses, even Boeing, said that they liked that idea. So big business was on board for it, too. But Premera Blue Cross, on its own, spent a whole lot of money lobbying the state legislature to get the bill killed that would have instituted the all-payer claims database. And they didn't sufficiently explain to anybody, and no investigative reporter really looked into why Premera Blue Cross, of all the insurance companies that were for the all-payer claims database, why it alone said that it did not want it and did its best and actually succeeded in killing what would have been a very useful tool for people. So I looked at that and I thought, what is Premera Blue Cross trying to hide here? You know, I thought that was very suspicious, and nobody really followed up on that.
All right. Seattle's $15 per hour. 15 now.
Yeah, you know, it got a lot of coverage all over the United States, our new $15 an hour minimum wage in the city of Seattle. And I just want to remind people that the $15 an hour minimum wage law that actually made it through the city council and actually got passed is really a $15 not yet for some people, and a $15 an hour never for most people, because it includes a sub-minimum wage for teenagers, something that the original proposal didn't include. And the business folks who were on the committee that came up with it really pushed hard and really got what they wanted, which was credit for tips, meaning that if you work in the restaurant industry, you're probably never going to be paid minimum wage as long as you also collect tips. Also, credit for healthcare costs. So if your business that you work for provides you any kind of medical coverage, then that can be deducted from your minimum wage. And bonuses. So a bonus is only a bonus if you make way more than $15 an hour already. If you make minimum wage, then your bonus can be subtracted from your hourly wage. And in my mind, that is absolutely ridiculous. That means it is not truly a bonus. It's just a part of your minimum wage that you only get paid either quarterly or once a year. And that's outrageous. So I just wanted to remind folks, we can be proud and pat ourselves on the back that we raised the minimum wage in Seattle, but it's not a $15 an hour minimum wage for just about everybody who's going to be getting it.
And the number of years.
And, of course, the number of years, yeah. Big businesses have up to about 4 years before they have to actually reach the $15 an hour minimum wage or the 15 not yet minimum wage. And small businesses have up to 7 years. So by that time, of course, the value of $15 an hour will be severely eroded, and we'll be thinking, why didn't we make it $20 an hour?
All right. Moving on, the carbon tax.
Yeah. BC's carbon tax has been a huge success, and it hasn't hurt the British Columbia economy at all. In fact, quite the reverse, that since their carbon tax was put into place, the British Columbia economy, or the British Columbia province in Canada, has seen a 6% reduction in greenhouse gas emissions. It's seen a 15% reduction in the consumption of oil, which means they're going in a really good direction. It has also seen that income taxes and business taxes have been decreased because of the revenue that's come into the state coffers, the provincial coffers, from the from the carbon tax. And it's also, you know, not seen any change at all in their inflation rate. So even though businesses had been whining, oh no, don't impose a carbon tax, additional taxes damage the economy, what they found in British Columbia that is that the carbon tax has actually been revenue neutral for them and has been a net win for individuals and for businesses because their taxes have gone down and it hasn't had any negative impact at all on their economy. Now, the governors, the state of Washington, here in the state of Washington, our governor's task force on carbon emissions recently was looking at whether we should impose a carbon tax versus a cap and trade. And anyone who's really looked at these two kinds of systems knows that the cap and trade has mechanisms within it that allow big polluters to continue to pollute as long as they're willing to pay, and that a cap and trade system is very tricky, and you have to have very, very strong enforcement to make sure there aren't any loopholes in there to let big polluters continue to pollute for very little cost, and that it's a lot easier to enforce a carbon tax because the tax is probably going to be the same. The tax is going to be the same for everybody. It's just based on volume of greenhouse gas emissions that you emit. So it was interesting to me to see the governor's task force come out and say, well, these two systems are pretty equivalent. It doesn't really matter which one you adopt. Both of them can be good as long as you have strong enforcement, particularly for the cap and trade system. So what was the one that Governor Inslee decided was the one he was going to propose for the legislature to pass? Well, he didn't come out and say, let's do a carbon tax, which in my mind is the preferential one. He came out and said, oh, let's do cap and trade. You know, that's the one I think we should do. So I think the question there is not, is the legislature going to pass it, which is a major question. Will the state legislature pass it now that the Republicans have taken control of the Senate? But I think the big question is, why is Governor Inslee, who claims to be a green governor, why is he pushing a much more problematic system, a cap and trade system, versus a carbon tax?
I'm intrigued that anyone would be saying that the government has strong enforcement on any of these issues, because it doesn't appear that that's ever been the
case.
Because
that's the, I think you have to, when you look at a system like this, you have to assume that enforcement is going to not be very strong, that what you have to do is you have to put in place something that has the fewest loopholes possible so that the temptation to game the system or manipulate the system is going to be very difficult for companies to follow through on. And in a carbon tax system, you'll find that that's more the case than you will with a cap and trade system.
And if we look at a parallel example, the enforcement over Hanford issues has been pretty meager.
Yeah, it's been pretty meager
in our lifetime. So I'm just having a tough time with believing enforcement, strong enforcement.
Yeah, I know.
All right. Moving on, but sticking with Governor Inslee, his proposed transportation budget.
Yeah, he recently proposed a state transportation budget. And our green governor, who said that one of his main goals when he was elected would be to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions and get us and really push forward on our agreement under the Western Climate Initiative, which is an agreement that we signed with British Columbia, Washington State, Oregon, and California. He came out with a transportation budget after his greenhouse gas emissions task force said that the major source of greenhouse gas emissions in our economy is from the transportation industry, not from the utilities industry, since we get a lot of our energy from what are considered quote-unquote clean energy sources, although they may not be completely environmentally neutral. I think a lot of folks have issues with hydroelectric power, particularly with the fact that dams block salmon streams in many cases. Still, our utilities tend to be fairly friendly in terms of greenhouse gas emissions. It's our transportation sector that is the biggest cause. He came out with a state transportation budget that has less than 20% of the revenue devoted to green transportation projects, about 18% of the budget, and only 6.7% is devoted to mass transit. Now, you can look at that and you can say, well, you know, your task force just recommended that you put a whole bunch of money into infrastructure for electronic vehicles and that you put a bunch of money into mass transit. And devoting only 6.7% of the transportation budget to mass transit projects is really not up to standard. It's not even up to your own priorities here. Meanwhile, the city of Seattle... Voters in the city of Seattle passed an initiative just to maintain basic funding for Metro bus service. This is just a huge disconnect here when at the state level, you've got the governor saying green transportation is a major priority. And then he comes out with a transportation budget that is almost 50% devoted to the construction of new highway capacity for drivers who are driving less. You know, when studies are showing that individual drivers are actually spending fewer hours and driving fewer miles on the roadways in the state of Washington, to devote 50% of your budget to building new highways just seems to be a huge disconnect from reality.
But he plans to fill those with electric vehicles and hovercrafts.
No, I don't think so, because there's not enough money in the budget to support that. That's my point.
All right. Moving on, the Seattle got a new police chief this year.
Yeah, you know, Seattle got a new police chief, and we've had major changeovers in the Seattle Police Department. We've had, what, four chiefs just in the last couple years? And, you know, this new police chief finally is starting to affect a real culture change at SPD. It's slow, but it's starting to show. And she's winning the approval of the court monitor, Merrick Bobb, who was appointed by the state Supreme Court to oversee the agreement between the Department of Justice and the Seattle Police Department on police reforms. He has been praising her, which is a real change for him too, because he had real issues with Jim Pugel, and he had some issues with the last interim police chief too. So Harry Bailey. It's kind of unusual to hear him now say, wow, you know, there's some real change being made. But if you can look far and wide in the local press and try to find any kind of articles that praise Kathleen O'Toole, our new police chief, and you'll see that what you're getting instead is panic articles written about how the increase in crime downtown, or articles written about, oh, you know, Seattle Police Department is not pursuing property crimes in North Seattle. And while that may be true, they don't really look at the issue of, well, could it be that that SPD officers are resisting reform at the Seattle Police Department and are doing a work to rule kind of protest, where they only go out on what they on calls that they absolutely have to, that they're not pursuing these smaller property crime cases, because to do that would mean that they really care about their jobs, and at this point they're only doing the minimum of what they have to. So you're not seeing anybody really investigating these issues of perceived crime downtown being linked to the fact that there are more homeless people. You know, what does that say about the city's messed up policies in terms of affordable housing and homelessness? And you're not seeing them say, look, you know, there's starting to be a change in how the police department does certain things, and that is because of Kathleen O'Toole. It's not because of anything that's going on within the police union per se.
There was regular reports coming out prior to her taking over about how SPD was complying with the federal rules that they'd come down with. Have there been any significant evaluations?
Yes, in fact, in Merrick Bobb's recent report, he said that there's still some issues that need work at the Seattle Police Department, particularly in tracking use of force cases. And of course, in providing information to the public as well, the SPD has done very little in terms of that. But in his most recent report, he had some very strong praise for Kathleen O'Toole. And I think part of the reason she doesn't get the benefit of the doubt and that nobody thinks it's newsworthy is because she's a woman. But that's my perspective.
All right. Moving on, the state legislature in contempt of court.
Yeah, just wanted to remind people, our state legislature is still in contempt of court, that the state Supreme Court this year ruled that, yes, they're holding the state legislature in contempt of court for not funding, adequately funding K-12 education under the McCleary court case ruling, which happened in late 2012. Two state legislative sessions have passed when the state legislature had the opportunity to adequately fund K-12 education, and they fell far short, leaving this the third and final year, these next 3 months, the last chance that the state legislature gets in this current legislative session that starts in January and runs through March and early April. That's the last chance they're going to get, according to the state Supreme Court, to adequately fund K-12 education. And if they don't do it, then the state is going to have to impose some sanctions. Now, no one's exactly sure what those sanctions are going to be. You know, it could be fines levied on individual state legislators. It could be the state Supreme Court saying, well, if the state legislature isn't going to find the money, we will. And here's the budget we expect the state to fund for education, which would mean cutting funding for other very important projects that the state funds, possibly also transportation. Or they could do what is my favorite sanction, which is they could say, well, we're just going, because the state legislature didn't pick and choose what tax loopholes to close, we're just going to close all of the tax loopholes in the state budget. I think that would be great if they repealed a whole bunch of tax breaks. So we'll see. My guess is that the state legislature will probably not fund McCleary to the court's satisfaction, and then we'll see what happens in May.
All right. And then finally
on the list,
University tuition.
Yeah, I wanted this to be on the list. I didn't want it to drop off my list of top 10. Washington Public University tuition has increased more over the last 6 years than any other state in the union, except for Arizona. From 2008 to 2014, tuition at our public universities here in the state of Washington increased by $4,085. The national average increase in tuition was $1,885. So we were more than double the national average. And now Washington residents pay an average of $10,811 to send their kids per year to send their kids to college. The taxpayer share of that, the share that is paid by the state legislature, has fallen 28% since 2007. So that's the reason why parents and students have to make up that big difference and why it's increased so much. And, you know, we look at kids graduating nowadays, and some folks roll their eyes and go, oh, I had to pay tuition too. But the tuition you had to pay was not the tuition that today's kids have to pay, and a lot of them are graduating with enormous debts, and it's affecting how much money they can spend when they do get a job in the economy. And as we know, consumer spending makes up a good 70% of the economy. So and also you have to keep in mind too that the young generation is a generation that is going to be funding the Social Security and Medicare retirement for the baby boom generation that is retiring right now. So when you put that kind of big debt on the shoulders of young folks who are starting in the workforce nowadays, you're really putting shackles on your economy, is what you're doing. And you're making it really, really hard for them to not just keep the economy going, but also to help fund the retirement for a large sector of the population that's retiring right now.
So we have the highest public university tuition increase. We've got the highest rent increase here in the city.
We've got record homelessness. Yeah. And all of these are issues that are just not being covered in the media here in the state of Washington. And I just don't understand why, other than, of course, there are some vested interests in business community that would much rather have the newspaper cover things like don't raise our taxes and we deserve a tax break. Boeing got not this year, but towards the end of 2013, got one of the biggest tax breaks in the nation, a $9 billion tax break from the state legislature to as an incentive for them to continue manufacturing airplanes here in the state of Washington, which there is no guarantee that they will do, in spite of the fact that they got this enormous tax break.
Well, they turned around and did multiple layoffs after that.
Oh, yes.
Shortly after mm-hmm. that. All right, so next week we can expect the national, international.
National and international, and by that time I'm expecting Job will probably be feeling better.